This is Teaching for Student Success. I'm Stephen Robineau. I'd like to start by giving a shout out to some of our non-US listening cities. I'm excited that Teaching for Student Success is listened to around the world. We have listeners in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia, Frankfurt, Freiburg, and Berlin, Germany, Dublin, Ireland, Valparaiso, Japan, Valparaiso, Chile, and Hiroshima, Japan, and many other cities. It's exciting. I'm thinking about generating a map from these data and putting them on our website. I think that would be kind of fun. Episode transcriptions are now standard thanks to a partnership with Trint. Trint, transcribing audio and video to text. Learn more at trint.com. Now let's get to today's topic. Teaching. Teaching is hard. It's wonderful. It's fulfilling. It's meaningful. Teaching is so many great things, but sometimes it's just hard and frustrating and exhausting, especially these past few years. So let's everybody just take a breath. In this episode, I guess everybody take a breath. I should stop for a second. Let's take a breath. In this episode, we're going to talk about how we think about and how we treat our students. A number of episodes deal with this issue. We have two episodes on instructor talk and one with Harriet Schwartz on connected teaching. But the episode that really overlaps with this conversation today is episode 3 with Dr. Bill Davis about the syllabus. As the instructor of record for any course, you are responsible for everything. And one major issue is course management. How does the course work? How do students get grades? What are the assignments? What are the expectations? Where can they find you? When can they find you? How can they find you? There's a huge amount of information that must be provided to students at the outset or before the outset of the course. Enter the syllabus, a universal tool we all use to communicate with students about the course. It is a contract. It isn't a contract. It is many things and can be used to communicate a number of issues. The syllabus is a one-way communication tool from you to your students. Have you ever taken the time to think about the importance of this document sort of in this way? I don't think I had the notion that it's a one-way communication tool. This document can set the tone for your course and for your relationship with your students. It defines the rules of engagement. So let's talk about the syllabus, how it is used, how it can be used, and how it can be abused. I'm excited to welcome Dr. Matthew Chaney, Assistant Professor and Director of Interdisciplinary Studies at Plymouth State University in New Hampshire, where he works in the Open Learning and Teaching Collaborative. Matt has written extensively in both fiction and nonfiction formats. We'll have a link to his website, and you can read some of his stuff. It's fun to read. Matt has joined us today, however, to talk about the cruelty-free syllabus. Welcome, Matt. Thank you for joining us on Teaching for Student Success.
Oh, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to talk about this. This is a fun and sort of scary topic. First, let's just start with the title, the cruelty-free syllabus. It makes me think of all sorts of things, right? I mean, what's the opposite of cruelty-free? Cruelty-embedded? I don't know. But I think I'd like to start where this whole idea came from. What was it that sort of led you down this road to develop this idea of a cruelty-free syllabus?
In some ways, it's a very short story, and in some ways, a very long one. The short story is that I was doing a professional development workshop for our campus. We do these at the end of the summer. Faculty present ideas to each other. I needed something, and I had just been reading some stuff about syllabi and thinking about ideas of how we are treating our students and my own journey as a teacher and as a student. And I needed a title that was going to convince people to come to my session instead of one of the five others, because nobody wants to be the person who has two people show up to their session. So I landed on somehow or other the idea of the cruelty-free syllabus, and I thought that would be attention-getting. Then afterwards, I put the Google presentation slides online, not really thinking anybody would ever look at them or anything, and didn't give it another thought. And then it sort of took off because it got linked on Twitter, and then eventually the Chronicle of Higher Ed and Inside Higher Ed and other places to have a life very much of its own. Suddenly I was stuck with this title that I had come up with rather quickly, just to encourage people at my campus to come see this quick professional development workshop I was doing. On a larger sense, I've been thinking about compassion and kindness in teaching ever since I was a high school student and was really unhappy in high school and trying to figure out why. That's when I weirdly, nerdily first read Paulo Freire and Theodore Sizer and some other educational writers.
Wait, how old were you?
16, 17.
Okay.
I know, it was weird.
It's unusual reading for a teenager.
I was an unusual teenager, but it bothered me. You know, I was so unhappy and I was trying to figure out why and how it could be better. One of the first essays I ever published was in this tiny, long-forgotten magazine. It was about, I forget what I even titled it, but it was something about the view from a high school student of how high school is ruining our souls or something. So it was an interest from early on, and these questions have carried through really my life.
Cool. Okay, so I do want to hear about that transition from what you did before to what you do now. So the title came up just as a hook, and it's a great one. So let's back off a little bit. I sort of laid out a few things that we might use a syllabus for, but maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about how, more generally, without judging, what's the purpose of a syllabus and how do we use them?
That's a great question, and one of the great problems with syllabi, because they are documents that serve a variety of audiences, and some of their purposes are, if not in conflict, at least divergent. I never gave a thought to syllabi until I became a college teacher, because I was a high school teacher for 10 years.
Hmm.
In high school, you just don't use a syllabus in the way that you do in college. And I had just never really thought about it until I started teaching college. And all of a sudden, we had these very serious documents that govern our courses.
Right.
And at first, I didn't even really give that a lot of thought. I just used ones other people had, and I sort of adjusted and put myself in. And it wasn't until the end of grad school and the beginning of my current full-time job that I really began trying to dig into the ways that a syllabus not only shapes a course, but shapes our attitudes toward a course and reflects our own educational philosophy. So the syllabus is doing a variety of things. One, it's just laying out a certain roadmap for ourselves and our students of where we think we're going to start and where we think we're going to get to. It lays out some goals. It lays out a schedule and assignments and all of that. It lays out policies. These are all great on a class level. But then it also appeals to audiences beyond those. It may have something to do with the department. A lot of people don't actually have full control of their syllabus because it's a syllabus shared through a department. It has to reflect some institutional priorities. I don't think my school is unique in having things that are required to be on a syllabus.
Right.
It then can be even more than that. If your syllabus is public, it could be speaking to parents. It could be speaking to students who are thinking about taking a course or thinking about enrolling at a school. It could be speaking to legislators and boards of trustees. So there are all of these different audiences that may have at least an opinion, if not an actual effect, onto the syllabus itself. And that makes it hard. It makes it an impossible document in many ways, because there's no way to satisfy all of those different audiences at once.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't, right? That's too much.
Right.
It's too many things to think about.
So I don't. I try to think about my course. You know, the one thing I can control is my course, and all of the other stuff may have to be there or may not.
Right. So let's talk about this notion of a cruelty-free syllabus. So what did you see that was problematic in a syllabus? What and when did you see it, and how did you decide to approach it?
I began to feel it as much as see it. And I started with my own syllabi, because starting out teaching college, I was cannibalizing other people's syllabi. And I was also, in some cases, I started out as an adjunct, and I was just sometimes teaching what had been handed to me. And I felt a conflict and a tension between my own personality and desires and some of the things that I had put onto the document itself. Because if a student would do something, would be late with an assignment or would miss class for some reason, I would then go back. My school, like many probably, has a fair grading policy. You can't offer to one student what you wouldn't offer to another. You have to stick to what you say in your syllabus. So there was a binding quality to this. And I found myself bristling against my own policies or even violating my own policies. And that got me thinking about, where is this tension coming from? I don't want to keep perpetuating this. I want to change what is causing tension for me. And then in grad school, I had the weird experience of first starting as an adjunct teacher, then going to grad school, because I realized I actually liked teaching college and I wanted to continue toward the PhD, so I might have some hope of doing it full time someday. And so I had a long teaching background and then arrived at graduate school and was quite literally handed a syllabus for teaching English composition that we more or less had to just follow. And that was quite an experience too. And so all of these experiences of first not really paying a lot of attention to my syllabi, and then realizing that some of what I had written and created, I was actually personality-wise and sometimes in terms of my values in conflict with. That led me to reflection. And eventually I got to my current job where I am encouraged because my job lives within a very progressive teaching and learning center. I was encouraged to experiment and to try things out and to push the boundaries and see what would happen. So that gave me the opportunity to really start digging in. And what I found was that policies that seem very small on the surface were actually the ones that reflected a tone I no longer wanted to put forward. Those were things like the attendance policy and the late work policy. Because I found, when I really looked at what I had done, that I had set up policies that were fundamentally punitive rather than fundamentally encouraging or empowering. And what I wanted was not to start from day one from a place of assuming my students would be violating policies. And instead, I wanted to start from day one with policies that would help my students be more successful. And that's when I really started rethinking things and playing around and experimenting and still experimenting. It continues to go forward.
So I like that a lot. That sort of gets to the title, right? This notion of going from a punitive syllabus, one that imposes rules that students have to follow, or there's consequences, to one that promotes student success.
Yes, exactly.
So it's really an attitudinal switch about you and your relationship with your students that really is at the base of this discussion. It's really about how you want to relate to your students.
Right. And that was how I always had wanted to relate to my students, but my syllabus didn't reflect that. My syllabus was the cranky old college teacher. I had to get away from that because that just is not who I am.
Right. So you finally, after time, sort of one day you looked at it and said, wait a second, this isn't me. The syllabus isn't me. This is not how I want to relate to my students. Let's think about that. And suddenly it set you free to reconsider the whole thing.
It did, because that was another thing in terms of setting myself free, is I think I had often imposed an assumption that I couldn't change as much as I could. Certainly when I was an adjunct, I didn't feel like I had any authority or power to change anything. When I was a grad student, you know, you're the lowest of the low as a grad student. I didn't think I had any power to change anything. Looking back in reflection, I think I had more power than I did, but I was afraid to assert it. Now, I assert myself all over the place, trying to make up for some lost time.
That's great. You sort of lay out in your works that people can find, you sort of lay out the basic areas of the cruelty-free syllabus that you're thinking about. You've already outlined two of them, or at least mentioned two of them, which is your attendance policies and late work policies. You sort of lay out four, or maybe five now, areas that you really think very intentionally about what they are and what they look like. So you've got attendance, late work, and you want to mention a few others?
Sure. But first I want to focus on a key word you mentioned, which is intentionality. I don't want to tell other teachers, this is exactly what you should do. This is what your late policy should look like. This is what your attendance policy should look like. who knows? I even sometimes have different policies for different classes because I have different goals. The key is the intentionality. You know why you're doing this and you know what it wants to convey.
You're not prescriptive about what it should be, but it's what it should be for you. This is what works for you in your class.
Right.
But you sort of identify the problem areas.
Yes.
Right. The sort of the key punitive areas maybe, you know, that if you look at a syllabus, it's like, well, where are you being punitive? Oh, attendance, late work.
And deadlines, similar to those. Again, we're talking about how we manage time, because one of the things that a syllabus does is manage the time that we have together, the 15 weeks or so, however long your term is. A syllabus is a way of managing time. How do we approach deadlines? So a revelation for me was realizing that I don't need all of my deadlines to be hard deadlines for the students because they're not hard deadlines for me. I have hard deadlines. I have to get my grades in to the registrar or they yell at me, for instance. So that's a hard deadline that's not really negotiable. What is negotiable are some of the others along the way. If I have something set up because I think it's the best to help students manage their own time, but I'm not going to look at that assignment for a few days myself, it doesn't really matter to me if I shift that deadline for some students as they need, when they need it. So that was a real revelation for me of realizing that I can keep some hard deadlines and allow those to be really meaningful and convey to the students, these are not negotiable. And then I can be a little more flexible with some of the others that in my job or even just with myself and how I run the classes, I'm going to be flexible with anyway. That's been very, very useful. And I'm very explicit about that with the students, which is another key point is that transparency and explaining to students why we set up policies the way we do, why we are doing things the way we do them can be super helpful because it helps the students internalize some of what's going on within a course rather than just receiving deadlines, knowing why those deadlines are what they are, knowing why I think they're a good goal to aim for this deadline, even if I'm not actually going to look at that work until the weekend, because it helps them manage their schedule.
Do you have some examples of your course of things that are soft deadlines versus hard deadlines? Just to give people a flavor for what that looks like.
Sure. I try to keep the soft deadlines for most of the middle of the course. We have hard deadlines at the end because stuff's got to get done and I've got to have time to read it and grade it and turn in the final grades for the course. Those are things I don't have any control over.
What about the attendance policy? Some people do take attendance.
Attendance is hard. Attendance is something I have been thinking about my entire career and I have never found a perfect solution for. We're still talking about it at our school because I think that attendance is not just about you and your course and your student. And this was something I had to learn over time. One, there are just all the other factors in a student's life, but there's also a certain school culture that we may not have control over. I've taught at different places and seen vastly different attendance trends with seemingly similar students. And I think that has to do with the type of school and whatever had somehow in the mysteries of how school culture comes together was part of that. So where I have gotten to now with attendance is we do actually have to take attendance because we have to report it for financial aid reasons. So we have to take attendance at the beginning and end of each term. What I tell students is that your attendance does not affect your grade directly. I used to have exactly those kind of attendance policies where you miss a certain number of classes and it lowers your grade by a third of a grade letter or something like that. I got rid of all of that, one, because I'm just terrible at calculating it. It's a pain in the neck on a bureaucratic level for myself. But also, it just didn't seem to be motivating. The kind of students who weren't going to come to class were still not coming to class. So I had attendance policies in the past where I paid attention very closely to students' attendance, and that was reflected in their grade. Now I tell them that, of course, attendance is going to in some way or another affect your grade because we need you to be here to be able to do the work. There's a reason we're in person. There's a reason that we are here together for this short time. And I promise not to give you busy work if you can try to be as attentive to this course as you can. I think we learned a lot through the COVID years too. When the COVID crisis first hit and we all had to reconfigure everything that we are doing, we learned what we valued and what we don't, what we can let go of and what we really want to hold on to. And I began to really rethink, what does it mean to be in person? Why are we having courses in person? And I realized that one of my courses really did not work in any sort of hybrid format. There was something about the being together in a space together that mattered. This was a lesson I was then able to bring to my students when I talk about attendance. I could say, I have chosen not to have this course be hybrid. I teach other courses that are hybrid. This course is not hybrid because we need to be here together. You need to be able to help each other. You need to be able to have conversations with each other in the same space. Let's make the most of that. And that's what I try to convey to them. So my attendance policies now are not tied to the grade, even as I try to encourage the students to understand how doing well in this course requires you to be present, requires you to show up to the best of your ability, even as we understand that that ability is going to change over time, as there are lots of different factors that are going to influence it, such as students who are working, students who have late night schedules, or student athletes have very difficult schedules. So all sorts of things affect all of this, but I make my best effort to show up to class every day. And so I ask my students to do the same. And that's, at this point, what I feel like is the most honest thing to do.
So you actually spend time talking with them, either talking with them or through the syllabus, talking about the importance of the personal interactions that occur or the conversations that occur in class and the benefits of that, as opposed to just assuming that everybody understands that.
Yes.
Again, a little more deliberate in delivery of message of why you'd like them to attend.
Yes, because one of the things that I discovered when I started teaching college is I assumed that students knew all sorts of things, and it turned out they didn't. And if you are going to college because you think that's the right thing to do and you want to get a credential, the reasons why you should show up to class may not be self-evident. If you're actually able to do the work pretty well without showing up to class, one, there may be some problem with the class that's set up in such a way that students can do really well without actually showing up. But if you experience that, and I think a lot of talented students have, then the value of showing up to class may not be apparent. Also, the group nature, I think, is often not apparent because we're used to thinking of ourselves as these individual entities going through. And yes, we are responsible for our own work as students. But for me, thinking back over my years as a student, one of the things I didn't realize I was getting out of it was some of the social interaction that was in many ways just as important for learning as the material of the course.
The sharing of ideas, the learning about other people, diverse cultures that you may or may not know about or have experienced, or a lot of diversity that you may not experience. And if you isolate yourself at home, you never have the opportunity.
Right. Absolutely. We are social creatures at heart. Even those of us who tend to be hermits, there is a social element to our being.
Yeah.
College is a great opportunity to explore that in a way that you often don't get at other parts of your life.
Okay, so we've talked about two of the features that you talk about in a cruelty-free syllabus, the attendance policies, late policies. You also put something in your syllabi that I don't know that many people put in, which is a basic needs statement. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, basic needs statements have become more popular over the recent years, partly because of studies that are showing how much food insecurity and housing insecurity there is among college students. And this is very true at my own school. Mine is a regional public university, the northernmost four-year college in New Hampshire. We serve a primarily rural population. There is a lot of hidden poverty. So as we have been thinking about it, a lot of faculty at our school have decided to put basic needs statements on as a way to encourage students to communicate with us or to seek out the resources that are available for them if they are not able to meet those basic needs of food and shelter. And this is important from a pedagogical standpoint because, and I tell them, if you cannot eat, if you cannot sleep, if you do not have good shelter, you are not going to be a good student. If my interest as a teacher is in a student's success, then I need to start with those most basic things of food and housing. And also there are mental health issues and such. All of those things that get in the way of learning, those are obstacles for students. We have resources on campus. we can help. It's my job as a teacher to help students connect with the resources that are available so that alternately and somewhat selfishly, they can be great students in my class. Mm-hmm.
In my teaching, I never had a statement like this on, but I was completely, I think, unaware of the needs of students at that time.
Yeah, we're not used to thinking about it because, you know, we want to think about our class. That's the thing that matters, you know. There's a part of me, especially years ago, where I would sort of bristle against these sorts of things because I just want to focus on my class. This is what I was hired to do. This is what I'm good at. I'm not an expert in all of these other things. I'm an expert in the thing I was hired to teach. That's what I can do. But I don't need to be an expert in the other things. I just need to know that there are resources all around to help these students, and they need to know that too. And the syllabus is simply one way for them to know it. But it's there, just in case. If I've got to have all the other junk that's required by the university, I can at least also have that in case the one day, the one student who needs it sees it.
Yeah. I suspect that on day one of your class, you go through a few elements of your syllabus, and I suspect you point out to this, you point to your basic needs statement so that students know it's there.
Yes, I do. That part and the part about getting help, the other part, even less intuitive to me, was the part about getting help, that it's okay to get help. One of my colleagues, Martha Burtis, I think, was the one who pointed out to me that this is something that it seems so obvious to us and is so not obvious to students, that you should ask for help, that it's okay to ask for help, and I want you to ask for help. We are here to learn. So I've just put that right onto my syllabus. It seems like you shouldn't have to put that there. But I also then think about my own experience as a student is, were there teachers I felt safe asking help from? Yes. And were there others I did not feel safe asking help from? Definitely. Because teachers have different attitudes toward the idea of help with the course.
So let me move on to the next item in your list that you talk about, and that's names. So you want to talk about names?
Yes, names are really interesting. And this is something where I never cared about it even for myself. People will ask me how to pronounce my name, whether to use Matt or Matthew, pronouns, all of that. And it's nothing I've ever been super attached to. Other people are very attached to it, and that's really interesting and ought to be respected, I think. For a lot of people, your name is the element of identity you can really hold on to. And so I think we all ought to be referred to by the name and in the way that we choose. Linda Barry has a couple of great books. She's a cartoonist and writer who has written a couple of great books about her really unique writing workshops. One is called, I think, What It Is, and the other is called Syllabus. And one of the things she has her students do is make up names for themselves for the whole length of the workshop. And they can just be whoever they want, and they can be an animal or whatever they want to be. And I thought, isn't that fun? I've never done that. I've thought about doing it. I thought, wouldn't that be fun? Because why do we have to be stuck to our official names in class? Wouldn't it be fun to make up who we are in class and try that out? I haven't ever gone that far, but it's a neat idea. And it got me thinking about the ways that we communicate about names and our identities within the classroom space. So I want to give students as much power and control over that as possible. I have those questions in our pre-class survey for them about who you are, what you should be known as, et cetera. And I encourage them to let us know.
And how have students reacted to your learning their names? I assume your classes are modest in size.
Yeah, my classes are usually about 25 students. At any one time, I have about 50 to 60 students, and I'm terrible at learning names. It's really, really hard for me. So this is partly another reason why we talk about names, is so that I can practice with my students. I think they've mostly responded well because it gives them the power. If this is something they care about, they know that I will care about it for them too. And if they don't, then, you know, no big deal. It's no harm to them or to me.
Right. Listeners of the podcast will have heard me tell this story before because it's one of my favorites, and I'll tell it again. I would ask my students what they would like me to call them. And one of my students, Oliver D, he asked me to call him Megatron.
That's great.
I've only ever referred to him face to face as Megatron.
That's wonderful.
It was. It was right. It was just so much fun. It's like, what? It's like, sure, I'll call you Megatron. I don't care. It's fun.
I think it's important too, because so many of our students, I do teach a lot of non-traditional students, students who are older than the traditional college age, but the majority of my students are 18 to 23 or 24. And that's a time of great identity exploration and formation. And so I want students to feel like they have the control there. They're in the driver's seat. There's no reason for me to impose, you know, their official name on them.
Can we talk about pronouns for a second?
Sure.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's a relatively, seems to me, a relatively new innovation. Is that the right term to use?
It is. I think it's relatively new because we're relatively more openly aware of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very, very important for a lot of students. We have a good number of trans students at our school, and also just students who are exploring questions of identity. And so I always ask students in the survey at the beginning of class for their information. I give them an optional question about, what are your pronouns? Do you want me to know them? It's important that this be optional, I think, because as someone who does not particularly want to define my own pronouns, I understand, I feel the need to not be tied to that. At the same time, as someone with friends and students and colleagues for whom pronouns are very, very important, I also want to respect that. So you need both.
As you've moved to a gentler syllabus, how have students reacted to that? Do they react to you differently now than they did before? And has it changed their relationship with you and with their grades, how concerned they are about them?
Yes, I will say first, the greatest benefit is purely for myself, because it has reduced my feeling like I'm on a treadmill, always running to catch up to grading stuff. Because I did feel a sense of personal responsibility when I had very strict deadlines and very, very carefully laid out course, I felt a great responsibility to keep up with it myself. And that got really hard, especially as life got busy. Letting go of some of that, being honest with students, has just removed a lot of anxiety from me. But I think for them, students come to us with a lot of experience of school, and a lot of that is negative experience. So it is a challenge for them to engage with a syllabus like mine if they haven't had experience with that before. I'm lucky to teach at a place where actually I'm not an outlier. There are lots of other interesting experiences students are having, and they're learning to read very different types of teachers and very different types of syllabi. So that's actually helpful. But for the most part, I think students don't believe it at first. I think that students think, well, that's all well and good. That's nice of you to say. But in the end, you're just going to be like all the other teachers, right? And so part of my job is actually to prove to them that I mean what I say, that the syllabus is not just a document, that the policies are there for a reason, and I'm going to stick to the ideals that they try to communicate.
Do you get comments from students about your syllabus? Give us some example of what that sounds like.
That they have a sense of caring in the course. They felt that they were empowered in the course. They felt that they learned things, but they learned things in a way that did not provoke anxiety. So those are the sorts of things that I hear from students. Also that they're always seeking out our courses again. They're seeking out these kind of experiences again. One of the things I often ask faculty is, what do you want students to remember about your course by the time they graduate? And what do you want them to remember 10 years from now? If students remember the content, that's great. But what I really want them to remember is that we cared and we tried to take care of them to the best of our ability, because that is how learning can happen.
I'm just letting that sink in, right? Caring is about how learning happens.
Yeah. Yes. One of my mentors, Jeffrey Pratt Beatty at the New Hampton School in New Hampshire, he was the one who actually turned me on to Theodore Sizer when I was a kid. He said that you can know an institution is healthy not by its money, not by anything, except that everybody there has a sense of being known, needed, and cared for. I've written about this, and it's something I come back to all the time, because you need a bedrock, and that's my bedrock. It's everything else is going terribly. This class is just a disaster. I'm behind on things. Students are behind on things, whatever. Do I still know my students? Do they know that I know them? Do they have a sense that they're needed here, that we need to be together in this course doing this thing right now? And do they have some sense that I care and they are invited to care as well? If I can get to that, then we'll be okay. We'll get through all of the whatever disaster I've made of this class.
Known, needed, and cared for.
Yep, nice. That's what I come back to.
That's great.
And it gets to the question of values. Yeah, I avoided the idea of values for a long time because I thought of values as a kind of authoritarian, fundamentalist imposition on other people. I've come back totally full circle to now thinking that values are what we need more than anything else, that the tools and the techniques will take care of themselves if we start from values. And so I've really tried to investigate in myself, what are the values that I want to bring to my work, to my classroom, to my life?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've talked to a number of educators, and I think you have these circles or these cycles or these progressions that you make. I guess progressions, they're not cycles, they're progressions that you make. And many of us come to the point where you realize it really isn't about the content anymore. I mean, you're experts in the content. You want your students to learn and be excited and enjoy the content and the field as much as we do, which is mostly why we do this, because we just love it and can't imagine doing anything else. And then you move past the content into the caring about your students and finding other meaning in teaching. Prior to starting this interview, we talked about Virginia Woolf a little bit. I had an English course when I might have been a freshman in college, and we read a couple of novels by Virginia Woolf, and I loved it, and I still remember this paper that I wrote. You are a Virginia Woolf expert. You mentioned that you might have a story to talk about. So let's hear a Virginia Woolf story.
I could talk for hours. Yes, part of my doctoral work was on Virginia Woolf. But this goes into exactly what we're talking about, because when I was an undergraduate, I took a course taught by a wonderful woman named Jean Kennard. She's no longer with us, at the University of New Hampshire, who was a British woman and a Virginia Woolf scholar and a scholar of women's literature. She was one of the founders of the Women's Studies program at UNH, just a really amazing human being, and terrifying because she was very British and very stern. And then there was this course where we basically read everything. We read all but one of Virginia Woolf's novels, plus a bunch of her short stories and essays and journals. It was a ridiculous amount of work. And I often think about it because, one, it inspired a lot of my passion for Virginia Woolf. It gave me the grounding I needed ultimately to do doctoral work in Virginia Woolf. And I somehow survived it. And I have been thinking about, why was that such a profoundly great experience when other courses with severe teachers who had, they said, high expectations for us were not courses that were inspiring, but were simply punishing. And I think that the reason is because Jean Kennard never stopped believing we could do it. And she had great delight in the material, and she conveyed that delight to us through the way that she talked about it. It just seemed to never occur to her that we wouldn't do the reading, or we wouldn't be able to keep up with the assignments or anything. And of course, we didn't keep up with all of the assignments. We were sometimes terrible students because it was a huge amount of work. And she just never let that phase her. She's like, oh, well, you'll catch up with it. It was never an option not to. It was an amazing, amazing experience that I draw on every single day. There was a way where a different teacher would have approached that same material in a much crueler way, in a way of, you must do this, and here's it, and you're shame on you for being late with this and not catching up and doing X, Y, or Z. And that just never seemed to occur to her. It was just, this is wonderful stuff. We're sharing it together. Of course you're going to keep up with the work. Get back to me when you do. It has been such a foundation for so much of my life in the 25 years since.
in the 25 years since. So here's you're telling a story now that gets to one of the questions you ask people when you talk, which is, what do you want your students, to remember in the future? You're talking passionately about a 25-year-old event.
A teacher who I never saw again.
Yeah.
I had the great honor of writing an obituary for her for the Virginia Woolf Miscellany because I wanted the world to know how extraordinary she was in the day-to-day work of the classroom that otherwise gets lost because it's an ephemeral thing.
Right. That, right? Only the people that experienced it, those for those decades that she taught.
Yes.
And then it's in your memories.
Right.
Now it lives on.
Indeed.
That's great. That's great. Matt, I want to thank you so much for your time today. It's been a great discussion about syllabi and students and faculty and relationships and transformations. This has been really wonderful. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
For more information about Dr. Cheney's work, his favorite books and papers, his writings, please go to our website, teachingforstudentsuccess.org. We will put a lot of material on the website. Maybe we'll put some syllabi material, example statements and things like that that one might use. I think I'm getting a head shake for that. Is that okay?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. So, I work in the Open Teaching and Learning Collaborative, so we're all about making our stuff available to people.
Yeah, and in the end, we'll obviously put a link to that on our website. I want to thank everybody for spending time with us today. Please share our podcast and website with your friends, colleagues, and administrators. We love hearing from our listeners. Please contact us through our website. If an episode has impacted your teaching, please send us a note and let us know what impacted you, what you've done in your classroom, and how it's impacted your students. Teaching for Student Success is a production of Teaching for Student Success Media. Let's end this podcast, as I always do, with some music of Julius H. Some of Julius's music can be found on Pixabay. And we're good. Matt, I want to thank you so much. That was so much fun. Sort of a meandering discussion, but really great.
Those are the best kind, I think.